Bruce Edwards, and welcome to this podcast produced by the International Monetary Fund. In today's program, we speak with Esther Duflo, co-founder of the Poverty Lab.
Poverty is made of multiple angles. It's not just lack of money, but it's also lack of education and lack of health and lack of information and lack of political inclusion and awareness and etc., etc.
Esther Duflo is a professor of development economics at MIT, and the Poverty Lab was set up to find non-traditional approaches to poverty alleviation. She also co-authored with her colleague Abhijit Banerjee, Poor Economics, a Radical Rethinking of the Way to Fight Global Poverty. I met Ms. Duflo after her Richard Good lecture at the IMF earlier this month.
So why has your work been so focused on poverty, on poverty reduction?
This is where you can make the biggest difference. I came to economics to study poverty. I didn't choose poverty once I was already in economics. I came to economics once I realized that it was a powerful way to make a difference of the life of poor people. So in a sense, the question for me was more, why economics and not some other field?
Is it getting easier to collect data in places like India where you do a lot of your work? And what is the impact on your work?
Well, I think what has changed is not so much the ease of collecting data, is the ability to access a range of data, so to combine survey data and experimental data and administrative data. And for example, for one of the projects that I presented today, there was a survey, there was access to the financial data, there was access to the census, and then you can kind of cross use this all these sources of data together and put them to creative use. It has also become easier with the advent of tablets to collect data, to have surveys that are really well designed for answering the questions that you want to answer.
But do you think that we have a much better understanding of how poor people live now because of access to data?
I think we have made a lot of progress. I don't know if it's the access to data so much that has made the difference, or the willingness to collect the data that was the right data to do that. In a sense, maybe 30 years ago, there was too much reliance on kind of aggregate statistics that are not necessarily that illuminating for understanding the precise way in which the poor work. And then there is now much more willingness to go out in the field and collect very specific survey data on the questions that are of interest. And of course, that combined with the growth in experimental work has given us, I think, a much better window on how people work and function.
And you know, in this, the book that you published with Mr. Banerjee, there was a great emphasis on the need to understand, you know, how the poor live. And did you feel, the more that, you know, you research the poor, do you feel at times that you're too far removed from, you know, the realities that these people live on a daily basis?
We tried not to be in that situation, because the more you are in this situation, the less relevant you become. So, I mean, we are in the privileged position of working on the effect and the design of real intervention that affects real people. So that gives you a pretty natural reason to go out in the field and see what is going on. So at a field level, I think there is no such danger, because you think, on the contrary, more and more people really trying to spend a lot of time in the field trying to understand what's going on. At a personal level, you know, you're kind of fighting against aging and, you know, more responsibility coming with that, and children and the like, which makes going to the field more difficult than it was before. So for me, that's kind of a struggle, in part because I think it's important, but in a larger part because I really enjoy it. So I get frustrated by the fact that I can't spend as much time as before in the field.
Talk to me a little about the Poverty Lab that of which you're a co-founder. You know, a lot of the focus on the issues there are issues that one wouldn't normally associate or wouldn't expect from a group of economists. You know, like AIDS, girls' school attendance, and women's leadership roles. How do you think the field of economics can help address issues like that?
Well, I think it might have been a little bit of an accident that this development took place within economics, in the sense that economists have always been good with statistics as well, and that has given us the ability to master the tools that allow us to look at the impact of various type of projects, not projects that necessarily have any impact on anything to do directly with income or money or stuff that economists could be traditionally as associated with. I think there is also the fact for development that it's been recognized for a very long time that poverty is made of multiple angles. It's not just lack of money, but it's also lack of education and lack of health and lack of information and lack of political inclusion and awareness and et cetera, et cetera. And therefore, it's not really even feasible to try and think of addressing poverty without being in principle open to all those dimensions.
And so your presentation today focused on the loss of money through corruption. What do you think the real impact on people, on the population is of these leakages? I mean, is it all about economics, or does it go beyond, an economic impact? Are there social implications there as well?
I think there are social implications there as well, because when people see that there is massive theft inside a system, I think they also lose confidence in it. So beyond the direct loss of income for them or of revenue for the government, depending where the source of corruption is located, there is also the loss of trust in what the government is doing. And that can be very nefarious and hard to avert. So, for example, in the context of health, there is big problem with absenteeism. So it's a form of corruption, if you want, to never show up for work. And there is a direct effect on health, because people, instead of going to the local center, which are closed half the time, go to kind of unqualified practitioners that are around the area. But there is a more general effect on sort of mistrust of anything the government does, and therefore mistrust on any messages that they have to share. So if the nurses is never comes the day where she tells you that, oh, you should immunize your kids, why would you take her seriously? She's, you know, why would you trust this person who clearly doesn't have your best interest at heart? And that's a big issue.
And you, I thought it was interesting that you wrapped it up by saying, you know, this is all about providing better customer service. Do you think that's a more effective approach to addressing issues like corruption, just improving the service that you provide the citizenry?
Yeah, so this is something that sort of I became increasingly conscious of. If you just fix the infrastructure and nothing touches the customer, then the changes will be much less likely to stick, because there's not going to be a constituency of people who are going to support you. So to continue with the example on health, once we try to work with the government to address the absenteeism problem by giving very strong incentive to nurses to show up. But I think people were so despondent about the system that they didn't come back. So the nurses showed up more for a while, but the people didn't come. So the health centers were still empty. And then there was a collusion between the nurses and the doctors that supervised them. So the entire thing fell apart. But the deep reason for it to fall apart was that nobody cared. And they come, they don't come, doesn't matter. Because the customer service, if you will, was really too bad.
So I was reading an article about you in a magazine that the IMF publishes called Finance and Development, and it was published back in 2003. And there's a quote of you back then that said that economics was a relatively macho culture. Do you think that has changed at all? Do you think that women's perspectives inform policy more than they did perhaps 10 years ago?
Not really. I think we still are grappling with issues of sexism that, not in development, I must say. Development is a quite gender-neutral field. It has men and women. But in macro, for example, almost every, there are only men.
Well, but do you think that that continues to be reflected in policy?
I would almost say it's the opposite, that I wish that some men would be working on gender issues, that I find it problematic that most of the work on gender is done by women, because that makes gender a woman issue. And it's not the case for race, thank goodness. A lot of white economists work on race issues, but not very many male economists work on female issues. So I think that's more the problem. If we had many more female macroeconomists, it might make it a friendlier arena, but I don't know if substance-wise they would do anything deeply different.
Thank you very much.
You're most welcome.
That was Esther Duflo, professor of poverty alleviation and development economics at MIT and co-founder of the Poverty Lab. You can watch the webcast of her Richard Good lecture at imf.org. You can also hear more podcasts while you're there or search for IMF Podcasts on your favorite podcast app.